The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2010 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2010. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Welcome to this seminar, Enhancing the K-12 Math Curriculum. My name is Brett Edwards. I'm from Atlanta Classical Christian Academy. Why don't we just start off with a word of prayer? Let's bow our heads. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your goodness, for how good you are. For an unworthy people, Lord, you continue to bless us. You give us such good gifts. You've revealed yourself in this world, and you've revealed yourself through the language of mathematics. And we thank you for the blessing it is to be able to teach our students. And we pray that we can reveal you and your nature in the world through mathematics. Pray these things now in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. Just to give me an idea, how many of you guys are grammar school math teachers in here? Any? Okay, how about the logic rhetoric school teachers? We're going to be doing, I'm doing my best, K-12, how we can enhance the math curriculum. It's inevitable someone's going to feel cheated on their way out of here. I'm a second grade teacher and just didn't feel like, you know, there was enough stuff for me. So please be patient as I'm trying to do a lot in 1 hour. You know, I would kind of relate this to this seminar. We're flying at about 30,000 feet and we're going at least 70 miles per hour. Okay, so some of you guys are going to be going through the slides, and I know how some of us are. We want to write down everything. Please be patient with that. If you have questions, I'm going to do my best to get to a question and answer time at the end. So save those questions. Write them down. And also, if you have, what was that person? What was that name? What was that idea? You can either get that after this session or even email me at my email address here. Okay. First, I just want to give you the vision for the seminar. I'll be discussing a wide range, a wide variety of ideas on how I think we can enhance the classical Christian math curriculum. I've been teaching for about 10 years. I'm not that old, but I can't even remember the years. I started when I was 21. I'm almost 31 now. And my history is I started off teaching math because I was good at it, and I did well, and I went to Georgia Tech, and I enjoyed mathematics. But it was really only 3 years ago when I really my eyes started to open to this crazy world of mathematics. And it was because of a classical Christian math teacher that gave us just an hour seminar, just kind of came in, walked out, had a nice bow tie on. And you know, this guy was up at, in Lancaster. His name's Dale Siegenthaler. I don't know if any of you guys know him, but he just really encouraged me and started to get me thinking about the possibilities. I am very excited about the potential for math in a classical Christian environment. I'm not super excited about where we're at right now, okay? And I'm not super excited about where I'm at right now. I'm going, whoa, I'm missing it, you know? And I just keep on reading stuff and looking at things and seeing things, and I'm discouraged about where I'm at, but I'm really encouraged about where I could be. And so that's why I decided to get into doing a few seminars, just the things that I'm passionate about how I think we can improve it. What we can do, in my own experience, I was tempted to think when I first started teaching math that successful teaching of mathematics was completing a textbook. If I could get to the end of the textbook and get all the homework assignments in and do a test on every chapter, then I had done it, you know, I got the book done. And I was tempted to think that. And I've seen that that's also a temptation for other math teachers, and I'm not the only one, if we can just finish the textbook. It's also a temptation in grammar school math, you know, and this is not, someone's going to come after me and say, I'm a grammar school teacher, I love math, but let's be honest, how many grammar school teachers would say, math is my favorite subject, you know, like that's the one that I would teach above any else. It's not as common. And so what we need to do is we need to think about how we can, you know, expand and enhance our math curriculum. I think if we can take some of the ideas that I present today, I think we can do some different things. We can create better thinkers. Some of the stuff I'm going over today is just going to create better thinkers. It's going to inspire our students with the wonder of mathematics. It's going to cultivate enjoyment in mathematical rigor. How many times do we see our students? They're frustrated because, yeah, it takes a lot of rigor. It takes repeated problems over and over and over again. How can we create enjoyment in that rigor? And I think it is possible. I think it can be done. To help uncover to our students the harmony and order of God demonstrated in the language of mathematics. You could also look at the seminars off the beaten path. You know, when someone comes back from a trip in Europe, what was your favorite part? Paris, London, Rome. You know, actually my favorite part was this little village, you know, up in the mountains. And that's what really inspired wonder in them. And I know that's not always the case, but that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be going off the beaten path here today. So if you're looking for a seminar, you know, I'm struggling with stuff in the textbook, you know, and I was really hoping to get some help with stuff in the textbook. This isn't the seminar, for you. This is what can we do to add to our math curriculum. Here's some of the stuff we're going to be looking at: math history, number literacy, algebra, geometry, number theory, mysteries of mathematics, probability, mental math, riddles, calculators, children's literature, and a math catechism. So let's start off with math history. I was really turned on to math history by a book. I would strongly suggest it's one of my favorite math books called Fermat's Enigma. Has anyone read that book by Simon Singh? Most of the math books I read are not Christian, and they're great still. They have a lot of great stuff. The only Christian, some people might know of a different one, but the only Christian math book that I know of, in just terms of book, is Nichols' Mathematics is God Silent. So most of the other ones are just, so you have to be careful when I suggest books. You know, you're going to get the evolution in there. You're going to get a lot of the stuff that we don't believe. But he has a great book called Fermat's Enigma. It's fascinating. And we need to teach our students the history of math, going as far back as the Babylonians, and really stressing the history of the Greek mathematics and so on. Because when we tell them the history of mathematics, it gives them the context for the ideas they're learning. Why did they want to learn this? Has zero always been around? You know, for the kids, just think zero and the equal sign. We just think the equal sign was always here. You know, and we need to give them the context. We need to give them the stories of mathematics. The seminar that I'm doing tomorrow will get really focused in on especially the Greek mathematics and especially Euclid. In the grammar stage, if you're a grammar stage teacher, you're going to need help. You might need help. Maybe you don't, but you might need help from upper school teachers. But we need to include these names in history timelines. It's sad. I didn't even know years ago of a mathematician named Leonard Euler. But and now I read more and more. I go, what a shame that I'm a math teacher and I didn't know who Leonard Euler was, or Euclid, or Archimedes. These names need to be included in the grammar stage. They need to know. They need to know the time periods. Relevant math history should connect with themed classrooms. I know it's a popular thing at some of your schools to have, this year it is, you know, the second grade does the Egypt, you know, and this period does medieval times, and this period does Europe. And I think we need to include these characters and these great figures, and they're not just important figures in mathematics, they're important in general history. And so we need to include math history and give them that. When we get to the logic and rhetoric stage, these great stories of math history just need to come out as we teach. We just need to be teaching, and we all of a sudden, I can't tell you how many times as I've gotten more and more into it, I don't have to plan for it. Some kid, you know, tell me about pi. You know, and I mentioned earlier in the math discussion group with some of the folks here, you know, if pi somehow comes up, I'm probably going to be talking about Archimedes and his pi estimation. It's just going to happen. And these stories, we need to get so familiar with them that when we're teaching, it just comes out. Thales for similar triangles. If we're talking about prime numbers, you could maybe go to Euler's prime number formula that we'll look at later today. Interweave stories with the concepts you teach. I think there's two especially important time periods to study. We need to look especially at Greek mathematics and their worldview and how they think. We'll talk a lot about that tomorrow, so I'm not going to get in depth about that. But also Renaissance mathematics. Renaissance mathematics is very Christian. And we today can't imagine that math and science actually had Christian foundations and people that understood it. I have no reason to believe Morris Klein wrote a book called Mathematics, Loss of Certainty. From reading the book, I would assume he's not a Christian. But here's a non-Christian saying this. One can go further and assert that these mathematicians, he's referring to Descartes and Newton and some of these guys, were sure of the existence of mathematical laws underlying natural phenomena and persisted in the search for them because they were convinced a priori that God had incorporated them into the construction of the universe. Each discovery of a law of nature was hailed as God, as evidence of God's brilliance rather than the investigators. And that's what we want to teach our students that's what they're doing in class. You know, they're uncovering the brilliance of God in their investigations, you know, and we're going to be, you know, that's what we want to get them in activities where they can, the eyes get big and they realize, you know, that's evidence of God's brilliance. And we do that when we interweave history into our curriculum. So math history is important. The next topic I want to talk about, this is a fun topic. I enjoy reading about it. Number literacy. Here's two quotes from two books that speak about this number literacy idea. In Western countries, most children learn to read and write, but even in adulthood, many people do not know how to think with numbers. Another famous book called Innumeracy. Innumeracy, an inability to deal comfortably with the fundamental notions of numbers and chance, plagues far too many otherwise knowledgeable citizens. So what is this idea of number, he calls it innumeracy or number illiteracy, and I think it's prevalent in our culture. And let me give you some examples. This is a fun one that I am able to do in my class. I draw up on the board or somewhere where I can get a really long line, right? And you say, all right, this is zero over here, and this is 1 billion. And you just ask your students one at a time to come up and go, put a dot where you think 1 million is. And it's amazing. I had one kid this year, one student that went past halfway, which I was, that was the moment. I mean, obviously that's what I want them to do. It's to expose the number of literacy. But this isn't, how many adults would do the same thing? How many adults would put usual answers around here, right? Okay, that's 1 billion, but man, 1 million's a lot, okay? Well, where's 1 million? That's the actual answer for where 1 million is. 1 million is almost at zero on this number line. And you go, how in the world is this the case? Well, let's look at it. That's 500 million, right? Because it's half of 1 billion. What's half of 500 million? 250 million. What's half of that? 125 million. What's half of that? Keep going. And finally, we get over here to 1 million. And we need to be taking our students here because this isn't just some kind of thing that they're not dealing with. They're dealing with numbers that they don't understand all the time, and especially when they get to become adults. What's another example of this? Well, thinking about the government throwing around trillions of dollars lately. What is $1 trillion, you know? It's a lot, you know? You ask a kid, what is $1 trillion? It's a bunch, you know? Well, I saw this. The first time I saw this, I think, was on Douglas Wilson's blog. So I'm glad that someone else is interested in our numerical illiteracy. But he had a link to this website. And this website showed us what $1 trillion is. Well, that's $100. That's $10,000. Okay, that's $1 million. That's 100 million. That's 1 billion. Okay, so you would obviously, when I get to this with my students, I'd be like, all right, so what do you think a trillion looks like? And this is $1 trillion. Okay, the difference, here's the little guy down here now. Remember? There he is right here. And now he's this big over here. And this gives them perspective. They need to be able to connect numbers with ideas. They need to be able to, you know, well, how much is $1 trillion? Well, remember we did that exercise, like thousands and thousands of pallets, right? Compared to, you know, here we have 8 pallets, okay? Or, yeah, 10 pallets, sorry. So this is number literacy. And we can take them on a lot of different adventures to discover this. There's another one you could do with the national debt, okay? This is in 2003. It's probably 10 times this, okay? So this is 6.6 trillion. Let's say one of our brilliant politicians says, I got a great bill, and we're going to pay down the debt at $1 million an hour, okay? And you go, this is great. We do this, and we're going to be in good shape soon. Well, if we did some calculations, 24 hours times 365 days times a million, that's about $10 billion, okay, for 1 year, obviously, right? So 1 year is just going to get us $10 billion. Well, what is 6.6 trillion divided by 10 billion? It's going to take us 660 years to pay off the debt at $1 million an hour. And this is, again, number literacy that our students, and obviously we as adults, I think, can enjoy it, but I think our students can enjoy it too. They can go, oh, that's cool, you know, that's neat. We're never going to pay off our debt. This is another fun one. One thing I love about math is a lot of times we're not so interested in what is feasible. We're just interested in the theory of it, okay? So don't get stuck on the fact that this is not feasible, okay? Let's take a piece of paper, an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and let's fold it 51 times, okay? The question is, how thick would this be? 51 folds of a piece of paper. We can only do it really 6 or 7 times before it's impossible. But if we were to do it 51 times, and I asked my students, okay, they're like, probably like that big, Mr. Edwards. And I'm like, whoa, that's really big. And so then we start looking at it, and we start doing some investigations, and we look at this. Well, one fold gives us 2 layers, right? Take a piece of paper, fold it over. One fold gives us 2 layers. 2 folds gives us 4 layers. 3 folds, 8 layers, and so on. And you put this is all I did this in Excel. And so after 10 folds, 2 reams of paper, 3 inches high, right? After 30 folds, we're 50 miles high. Okay, this is the power of exponentiation. We see a lot of these examples. I've seen them done in movies. One of the M. Night Shyamalan movies, I don't know if it's kind of weird movies, but one of them, he had it about if you started with a penny, if you said, hey, would you rather have like $1 million or $100,000, or I give you a penny on the first day of the month, and then I double it every day until the 31st day, right? And you should definitely go for the 31 days double because of the power of exponentiation. This is almost to the moon at 42 folds. If we were to fold this little piece of paper 51 times, we'd be past the sun, okay? And again, you know, students go, I don't think a piece of paper could reach past the sun. But again, as it gets folded more, it gets infinitely small and infinitely taller. And this is the paper folding experiment. So just giving them, this helps them with how powerful exponentiation can be. Number literacy provides perspective for our students in a world full of numbers. Okay, it's fun too, it's just enjoyable. And frequent investigations helping our students understand the significance of numbers is critical, I think, to their math education. You're not gonna find a chapter in your book, you know, let's look at these crazy, but I think it helps. It helps them understand numbers. Let's look at another area that I think we need to improve in, and that's algebra and geometry. I think grammar level, as we're looking at the K-12 math curriculum, I want to give some ideas for those that might say, hey, you know, I'm a grammar level teacher. I want to do my best to help produce a great math student. And some are very willing, and they're just looking for ideas. And so that's what, as a logic rhetoric teacher, I've come up with some things I think would be very beneficial. Collaboration is a critical component. You, as a faculty, I don't think you can do a great job of teaching math K-12 if you're not talking, if you're not communicating, if you're not getting together. And I know it's hard. We experience it at our school because there's so many other things going on, especially the smaller that you are, the more hats you're wearing. But it is a critical key component for us to do. We need to be getting together. We talked about this earlier in Linda Janikowski's math group. It's very important, I think. Every K-12 institution should have a math chair overseeing the K-12 math development. They are the one helping. Everyone goes to them as they think of new ideas. They ensure, I think one of the goals would you ensure all students are progressing adequately. You know, you can't look at each student personally, but you have to have that. It comes to you. Well, I have a few kids. Okay, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to pick them up? Developing more effective curriculum. What is better? What could do a better job of communicating this? And then your job is also to communicate the vision for the math curriculum to all teachers. I'm not sure where I got that. Jacob's textbook does a little bit of this, and I know some other places, but if we were doing what I call balance scales or equivalent scales from a young age all the way, I do it with my Algebra 1 kids, and I pull out Recently, we got a physical scale, okay? And I pull out a physical scale, and we go through and we think of this idea, and it helps them understand connecting equivalency, and it prepares them from algebra, and it can be done at a very young level. And I'm going to show you a resource at the end where you can get something like this, but let me show you examples of what I mean by this. Let's say, I think this could be applicable to a first grade class. So let's take this first grade. Maybe a first grade teacher will come up later and say that they could never do that. But let's say you put it in a bag, and it's a question mark bag, and you go, how many green bears are in the bag? Okay? And then you have a whole bunch of these little bears, and you start doing it. Well, let's say you put one bear and nothing happens. Okay, this is first grade, and they're doing this. And then you put two bears, and then you put three bears, and then you put four bears, and you put five. And then at five, it balances out, and then you go, well, kids, how many bears are in the bag? And they go, five. Okay, and they're right. Now, what I'm doing is I'm setting up with a really easy example. Okay, and this is according to the seven laws of teaching. And what you do is you take this all the way up, and I do this, and we're going to get to an example in a second, with Algebra 1 kids. And it's effective, and it's better than just, I think we get too quick to just thinking it's all notation. Okay, it's all about algebraic notation. It's all numbers. We do this. The kids seeing this, it makes sense. Well, let's look at another example. Maybe this goes up to third grade or something. How many blue and red bears are in the bag? So we put a red bear, a blue bear, a blue bear. Oh, that's too much, right? So we have to take that last blue bear off, and then we put a red bear. Oh, so there must be two red and two blue bears in the bag, okay? And there's an infinite amount of activities you could do with something like this. You could so many different ways. So now let's get to more of a pre-algebra, Algebra 1 case. So this is K through 12. We're looking at how we can do this. And we would do this every year, right? We would try to communicate this to our faculty and say, hey, and maybe the person in charge is setting up activities for each grade level to do, like, and obviously communicating and teaching. I know it takes time and effort. But what does one red bear equal, right? Now it's different. I don't have the question mark here. And so I asked my kids, and we've done this in my class before, and I put it in here. I go, what do we do? And then some kid goes, oh, let's take one green bear off both sides. Okay? Then you do that. Oh, yeah, it's still equal. They stay equivalent, right? And then one of the errors that I always show them is I go, oh, you might think you can take a red bear off one side and a green bear. And see, the thing is, it makes sense that you don't do that here on a scale for them, right? But in algebra, they do it all the time incorrectly. You know what I'm saying? Like, no, none of the kids would be like, well, Mr. Rivers, you take a red bear off here and a green bear, and they're still equal. No one would do that, right? But they do that algebraically all the time, and they don't, and they're just like, I don't get it, you know? Well, this is when they can go, oh, I know what you're talking about. I see why it doesn't happen. So let me go back again. You have two. You take off one green bear from both sides. Then you take off one red bear from both sides. Oh, Mr. Edwards, one red bear equals two green bears. And then that's when I introduce to them, oh, find x. 2x plus 1 is equal to x plus 3. Okay? And I go, what do you do? Well, you take off one from both sides. Okay? And that's taking off the green. What do you do next? You go, oh, you take off a red bear from each side. What are you left with? One red X bear is equal to two green bears. Okay, and this is what we can be doing. Now, the point is not, please, I think this is a great tool. I think the balance scale is a great tool. But I'm trying to use this as an example of you could do this with many different things, and it needs to be, if it could be repeatable, it's better. Okay, if it's something that first grade, second grade, third grade, and I don't think every teacher needs to be the same. They don't need to do all the same thing. I think it's great to have diversity in teaching. But when they see, oh, it's the scales, I remember. And then what happens in second grade, they review what first grade did. Remember when you did this? How many green bears? There's four green bears in there. And then you do it a little differently. And then you keep doing it. And this is huge for comprehension, I think, for our kids getting there and them understanding that. So if you're interested, I got mine from a place called Discount School Supply. I don't get any money for this. But discountschoolsupply.com has these little scales and these bears that you put them on. And obviously, younger kids, it's great fun for them to do. And older kids are patient with it. So, but anyways, I think that's a great tool. And it's a great example of what we should be doing more of. Another area that I find critically that my students, when they're coming up, don't have a good grasp of is just number sets. We were talking about Linda's class last year in Atlanta. She talked about math language. It's super important. Our kids need to understand the language of mathematics. Okay, we don't need to drop words that like, oh, that integer word just trips them up all the time. Let's use something else. Okay, and I joke sometimes about I can have. A lot of my kids coming into seventh grade can define subtrahend for me. Like, what every single kid knows how to define subtrahend. I don't think it's a bad word to know, but none of them could define integer for me, right? And we need to define, what are the words that are really important? What is the terminology? You're not going to have many kids in 11th grade math using subtrahend. You know, they're not going to use it in talking, right? But should they use integer? It should come up. You know, it should be often used. These are the words that we should probably put in the grammar stage. This is the stuff they need to memorize and need to know. So what I've thought of is I think it would be really effective is in the grammar school, think of this black box as like something we could put on the floor, okay? And it has dots on it. And they just need to learn first what are called the natural numbers. That's the first thing kids need to learn, natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And they don't need the line in between because this is whole numbers. We're not yet to that line in between. And they need to first get this. And you can do fun things, you know, put the first grade kid on 2 and say, what if I had 3? And then he walks over to 5. I'm at 5, you know? And you can do fun things like that. So first thing they need to learn is natural numbers, or thinking the number line. Then you go, guess what? What's the problem with this number line, kids, at some point, you know? Well, what if I put you at 2 and I ask you to subtract 4? And they're like at the end of the thing going, I don't know what to do, right? And that's when you introduce them to the integers, okay, whole numbers and their opposites. And you still have just dots. And you could maybe have some, I don't know, I'm just visioning it. You could have just this, and then you kind of flip over a thing, and then it has all these, you know, negative numbers over here as well. And then the important number groups, natural numbers, integers, then they need to go to, well, now we can do subtraction, right? It's not closed under subtraction. Well, it's still closed. You can't do division, right? We can't do division. So if we want to do division, wait a second. We're going to do something before we get to division. You know, I just gave an example of like 3 minus 7 plus 9. You could put a little Susie right there and add 3 and subtract 7. Add 9, and she ends up at 5. Okay, that's an example of what you could be doing with kids, and they're getting up, they're physical, they're moving. If we're going to do division, we need to get to rational numbers, and that's when we get that line in between there. These are the fundamental number groups that we're dealing with in the grammar stage. Get to rational numbers. And then the fun next group, which is, this is when everything gets murky, and it gets way murkier after this too, but irrational numbers, okay? And this is just super fun for those that are familiar with their math history to get into irrational numbers. And then you can get into the Cartesian coordinate plane, okay? And you can have kids plot points by walking, right? Plot the point 3, 1, and they walk to 3 and go up to 1. And then at some point, obviously, not in the grammar stage, you get to imaginary numbers. Good luck with that. geometry is kind of a love for me. That's the class I've taught more than any other. And so I obviously have some ideas on how we can be doing this, but we need to return to a classic emphasis on constructions and proofs. I'm sure there's such thing as doing too much proofs, but I don't know where that is. We need to get back to doing constructions and proofs, and this is what Greek mathematics is all about. As you learn more and more about Greek mathematics, you learn that, I mean, if Euclid and Archimedes and all these guys were sitting in my geometry class, they'd probably be laughing half the time, like, this isn't geometry. You know, it's far different today than what it was. And I'll be delving into that tomorrow, and I hope you'll come to the seminar tomorrow. Grammar-level teachers can help students prepare by really two things, I think, that can be done. Introducing and familiarizing students with a compass and how to wield it effectively. I didn't think it was that hard to use a compass until you try to teach kids. But, some of my favorite ones, I forget, this is my favorite one. They hold it and they move the paper, right? So it's just like, what made you think that was the best way to do this, right? And so one of the things that the grammar stage can do is just teach them how to use it. Just, you know, how do you use this well, right? Because in my geometry class, they're going to be using this all the time. They're going to be using it all the time. Almost at least every, you know, 3 or 4 days, and sometimes more than that, okay? So easing students into the logic phase, and we talk about this a lot. I know this is not new, but we know that kids don't go home for the summer after their sixth grade year and all of a sudden develop some portion of their brain that's like, now I can do logic, right? It's not just overnight that this happens. And we can't think that we have to ease them there. Okay? And one of the ways I think we can use them is we can start asking questions that require justification. Why? You know, not just, okay, what is the answer? So why did you get that answer? Especially when it's correct. When they get the right answer, that's especially when, well, how'd you get it? You know, what was your thinking process? And developing the steps. Geometry emphasized the idea, this is more for upper level, but we need to emphasize the idea of what's called a collapsible compass. This is important to Greek mathematics, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. Unmarked straight edge. The basic constructions, these are some of the constructions that you could be doing, I think, on a grammar level, and doing it over and over again. I don't think the kids would get tired. I think they'd love it. Describing a circle, bisecting a line, bisecting an angle, constructing an equilateral triangle, constructing a square, transferring segment lengths. So when they get into that geometry class, it's not, you know, they have some familiarity. They know what they're doing. They know how to use a compass and so on. All right. The other area is proofs. Geometry is the use of logic to prove deductive reasoning. If you're in the logic class last period, we were talking about deductive reasoning to prove mathematical concepts. Geometry demands great logical rigor from the students. So, as I said before, we need to start asking the questions why earlier and not just stun them and get the shell shot. Geometry is a very difficult subject to teach if we're going to do it right, because it is so heavy in logic, and it's different from what a lot of grammar school mathematics is doing. And so they're like, where is this coming from? So we need to know where they're going and help them as they get there. Number theory. Number theory is a fun area of mathematics. I would say it was one of the big areas where I get the most wows from my students when I talk about just the crazy aspect, the crazy patterns that happen in mathematics. And so these need to be done often. You're often not going to find these in a textbook. It's especially focused on the integers and the patterns and behaviors of numbers. G.H. Hardy, a famous mathematician, British mathematician, said, "No one has yet discovered any warlike purpose to be served by the theory of numbers." Mathematicians throughout history have sought to make sure that their stuff could not be applicable. Some of them have been really proud. He was one of them, G.H. Hardy. He didn't want this. He didn't want math to be judged as valuable just because it could serve some sort of purpose. He's like, it's valuable in and of itself, which I agree with, and I think there's a place for its practical purpose. The funny thing about his saying this is, number theory was very instrumental in cryptography in the 20th century, and so it was after he died, and he's, yes, you know, I've done some stuff that no warlike purpose, and here comes cryptography and starts using what he learned in number theory. And this gets to, basically, this speaks to what Eugene Wigner, a physicist that helped with the atom bomb, he called it the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. As a Christian, I would like to call it the reasonable effectiveness of mathematics. We believe in a God of order, you know, and harmony, and so it would make sense that we'd find order and harmony. As an unbeliever, they're like, why? You know, why is this happening? So, why number theory? This is my notes. But number theory can create awe and wonder in our students, okay? So they can start seeing the mysteries of mathematics, and we're going to get to some of those too. Perfect numbers were the first people to look into perfect numbers were the Greeks, okay? The Greeks saw perfect numbers, and perfect numbers are where the divisors of the number sum up to itself, okay? So you have 6, 28, 40, 496, all their divisors, when you sum them up, sum them up to themselves. I love the fourth one, 30, you know, the next perfect number after 496 is 33 million. There's some other interesting characteristics, though, to perfect numbers. One thing that they found about perfect numbers is, take the number 4, okay, and if you add up the divisors, 1 plus 2, it almost comes out to be a perfect number. It's 3. And it's what they call slightly defective. The number 8, okay, is 1 plus 2 plus 4. Oh, almost a perfect number. It comes out to be 7. And there's an infinite amount of these, okay? You could do the same with 16 and so on. There's an infinite amount. of defective numbers. The funny thing is they say, okay, well, what about excessive numbers, ones that come out to be one more? And they still, you know, and we don't know why. It's just the way the world is. But there's not one slightly excessive number. There's not one number whose divisors come out to be one more than it. Okay? There's, you know, like 4 comes out to be, the divisors come out to be 3. There's nothing that comes out to be 5, for instance, in that case. And they keep searching, and there's no really proof. Okay? They don't have a proof that there isn't one that exists. So what do mathematicians do? You know, try to find a proof or try to find a counterexample, right? And they haven't found one. Another fun thing is amicable numbers. The Pythagoreans discovered what are now called amicable numbers, and they're pairs of numbers where the sum of the divisors equal the other number, so not itself, right? And the first ones that they found was 220 and 284, all right? And you see here the divisors of 221 plus 2 plus, all those sum up to 284, and the divisors of 284 sum up to 220. Well, the fun thing about amicable numbers is, for some reason, Pierre de Fermat, who's a fascinating character in math history, he's called the Riddler, and he was the guy that would say, "Hey, I've proved something. This is what I've proved, and I have a great proof for it, but I'm not going to show it to you, or I don't need to prove it, right?" And so then what people would do is they'd go and find the proof and go, "Yeah, I found the proof." He goes, "I know. I already proved that to be true a long time ago." And the English mathematicians hated him especially. Well, he discovered a remarkable pair of 17,296 and 18,416. Kind of a little bit of a rival to Fermat was René Descartes. And so he goes, "Oh, you found a amicable pair of numbers? Well, how about this amicable pair of numbers? 9,363,000, and then 9,400,000. And then... This is one of my favorite, Leonard Euler. He goes on and finds 62 amicable pairs, okay? I guess they just had more time on their hands back at this time. But and then one of the greatest parts about this whole story of amicable numbers is this right here. The second smallest pair was found in 1866 by a 16-year-old. So they go on. Look, Descartes's like, "I found 9,363,000. Euler finds 62, and they... missed the second smallest pair that this guy finds at 16 years old, which I always tell my kids, hey, go out there, figure it out. You know, maybe there's one smaller than this pair. And so that's a fun thing for them to see. Another area of number theory is a fun thing that I did with my students this year was Euler's prime number formula. We've always been interested in finding a formula that would pump out prime numbers. You know, if you put in any number, it would give you a prime number. And so Euler tested this one. He goes, n squared plus n plus 41. And so let's test for 0, 1, and 2. Okay, you put in 0, comes out to 41. Put in 1, comes out to 43. Look at this. This is great. We're coming out with prime numbers. And so does it work for all integers, right? Because as a mathematician, you know, it's fun to do this. We're going to look at it more scientifically right now. Mathematically, we'd look for a proof. But what I do with my students, and I had 3 students that I was doing this with, and it was great fun. So we're on Excel, actually, and I have them do a formula in Excel to calculate, and I go, okay, let's do 1. And I have another kid on another computer. He has the list of prime numbers there. And so one kid puts it in, and it comes out to be 41. And is that a prime number? And the other guy, yep, prime number. And then we go through, and we get to 39, and 1,601, prime. And this time they're kind of getting tired. Of course, Mr. Edwards, they're all going to be prime. You know, it works, right? Not 40, okay? 40, put in 40, and it comes out to be 1,681, which is a perfect square of 41 times 41. And it's just so funny. I just remember when we were doing it, you know, I forget who it was, but it's, I think it was Andrew, goes, okay, it comes out to be 1,681. He goes, prime, no, it's not. It's not here, you know? He's just like, he's dumbfounded. He didn't, because we'd gone through 39 where he found it. And then it doesn't come out. Why? Well, they've actually done computer things with his prime number formula, and it actually only comes out 48% of the time. If you do it like up to millions, will it come out, which is actually pretty good. It sounds like it's not very good, but that's actually a really good percentage for all the formulas that they've tried. A Hungarian number theorist named Paul Erdős, he said it will be another million years at least before we understand the primes. Okay, just how, and this means there's a lot of fun areas of prime numbers that we can be exploring with our students. Another fun one is the Goldbach conjecture. Goldbach conjecture states that every even integer greater than 2 can be expressed as the sum of 2 primes. So you say 4 is the sum of 2 primes, 2 and 2, 6, 3 and 3, and so on. And 60 is the sum of 17 and 43. Well, the question is this true, right? Is this true for all numbers? And we have a computer, okay, that has proven this conjecture true for all even numbers up to 10 to the 18th power. Well, is that mathematical proof? No. It seems like it's pretty likely, right? No one's been able to. And this is, if you know about Fermat's Last Theorem, this is kind of like Fermat's Last Theorem. It's one of these things that you're making in the history books if you can somehow figure out a proof for this. And our, you know, I think it's fun to bring up with your students, like, so they can prove this. I go, but they can't. And they go, but yeah, but a computer did. I go, yeah, but what about the beyond that, right? And so Goldbach's conjecture, one of those unsolved theorems still out there. Mysteries of mathematics. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. Romans 11:33. So the more we learn about mathematics, I think the more we learn how much we don't know, right? It's just such a deep subject. There's so many areas that we don't know everything. And so we need to be taking them into these mysteries. We ought to show our students the mysteries, and it helps them understand the infinite gulf between finite man and infinite God. Okay, and we've had times in history, and it's one of the mathematicians of the early 20th century, his name was David Hilbert. He was so happy because he thought at some point math and science would do it all. We could figure out all of it, right? We're learning so much. And then came along Kurt Gödel, and he came up with every system of logic is going to have like some sort of circular reasoning inconsistency. There's no way we'll ever be able to do it. And so this is a good way for students to understand the distance between God and man. I love looking at non-Euclidean geometry because it boggles their mind. We're just going to take a brief look, but there's a lot of different exercises you can do. Non-Euclidean geometry is basically very interested in the idea of parallel lines, and that parallel lines, in Euclidean geometry, parallel lines never intersect. Okay, in non-Euclidean geometry, it's not true. They might intersect. And I give the example with, you know, the longitude lines. Okay, the longitude lines, they're right there at the equator, they're parallel, and they intersect. There's a lot of questions. This is when you get into non-Euclidean geometry, another subtopic called topology, it just gets all kinds of confusing. But it's super fun as we look at some of the stuff. For instance, let's look at geometry on a sphere. Okay, we're going to look at geometry on a sphere. And let's look specifically at a triangle on a sphere. Let's draw one line down from the North Pole down. Is that a straight line, right? I've come right down the longitude. That's one line, right? Well, let's do another one. This is another straight line. And this is another straight line along the equator. So three lines that are connected, whose endpoints meet each other. In Euclidean geometry, it's a triangle, right? So this is a triangle as well. But what do we know about triangles and the sum of their angles? Well, 180, okay? Well, is that the case here? If we look at this, there's two 90-degree angles down here, right? And so you have 90 plus 90. What in the world? This is a 240-degree triangle, okay? And this is just like some of the mysteries. And then one of my favorite parts about this is we see this non-Euclidean triangle pretty well, but there's another one here that's not seen so well. What's the other triangle? That triangle right there. And you go, what? It has three sides. It just comes all the way around. And is this a 240-degree triangle? No, this is way bigger. This is an 840-degree triangle, okay? This is the non-Euclidean geometry. And I know this is, you know, some of you guys are like, I teach first grade, okay? this is probably more for, but it's just showing you the possibilities of what we can be doing with some of our students, okay? this is game theory. Game theory is, have you guys heard of game theory or maybe the prisoner's dilemma and stuff like that? I love it. It's super fun. But here's an example with game theory. And this is within the realms of mathematics. And we can be doing this, especially with some of our logic rhetoric students. Let's say we have three clowns. I've given them the names Gonzo, Binky, and Chuckles. My wife was like, don't put those names on there. But it makes it more fun. So we have Gonzo, Binky, and Chuckles. And they're playing a game of darts. This actually comes from an issue of American Mathematical Monthly back in 1948. So this is an old illustration. But these three clowns are playing a game of darts. And let's say we know that Gonzo hits 80% of the time, Binky hits 60% of the time, and Chuckles hits 40% of the time. And they start playing, but what they do is they cast, they roll dice, roll to see who goes first. So it's totally random who goes first. And what they're doing is they're throwing darts at each other's balloon, and when your balloon is burst, you're out of the game. Okay? And the question is, if everyone were to take the obvious strategy, who would win? And your students are obviously, they should say, and I would say as well, well, Gonzo's the best shot. He's 80% shot. But they've found out, probabilistically, calculating the probability, that the obvious strategy would be for Gonzo to shoot at Binky's balloon, right? Because he's 60%. Who should Binky shoot at? He should shoot at Gonzo's, right? Okay. And who's Chuckles going to shoot at? He's going to shoot at Gonzo's as well. Okay. And this, you know, this illustrates to me now, when I used to play Risk when I was young, my friend Andy Means, who scored an 800 on the math SAT, he didn't always win at Risk. You know why? Because he was Gonzo, okay, and we all ganged up on him, okay, and he knew that Australia was the key in Risk, okay, and we'd all gang up on him, and he would lose, and he hated it, and we were like, you're obviously not the best player here, and he was hitting 80% of the time, but Binky and Chuckles, I don't know which one I was, but we'd gang up on Andy. And so the probability is Chuckles is the most probable to win this game. Now, he's not obviously going to win every time, okay? But he has a 37% chance by the obvious strategy to win because everyone gangs up on poor Gonzo. Well, this can get more fun, okay? How can it get more fun? Let's say they gang up on Chuckles, okay? There's no reason Chuckles should win this. So Gonzo and Binky say, hey, let's both get the poor player out first, okay? So in this strategy, Gonzo and Binky go for Chuckles. Who does Chuckles go for? Chuckles still goes for Gonzo. So who's going to probably end up the most likely to win here? Again, probabilistically, Binky's the one that's going to do it because now they're ganging up on Chuckles, but Chuckles is still shooting for Gonzo. Okay? Gonzo's going, this still isn't my best, you know, chance. So what does he do? Gonzo threatens Chuckles. He says, if you shoot for me, I'm shooting for you. Okay, so you need to shoot for Binky, all right? Well, that is definitely a wise move, okay? So Binky still shoots for Gonzo, but Gonzo and Chuckles shoot for Binky, and in this case, Gonzo has the best chance. Well, what is Binky going to do now? Now they're both going to threaten Chuckles, okay? And the funny thing is they're both going to say, don't shoot at me or I'll shoot back at you. And the weird thing about this in game theory, his best strategy, Chuckles' best strategy, is to shoot into the air. Okay, it's actually better for him because if he does shoot at one of the other ones, they're going to retaliate. Okay, so Binky's just like, whatever, don't shoot at me. Okay, and he throws it over there, and then what ends up happening? They fight it out. One of them, you know, ends up winning, and it's usually going to be Gonzo. He still has a little bit better chance, but Chuckles is still pretty close to winning by throwing in the air. And this is game theory. And the game theory has applications all over the place. This is what's fun about it. It has applications. Elections is all about game theory. Okay, how in the world did that guy, you know, end up here and stuff like that? There's the prisoner dilemma is another example of game theory. And that's some fun stuff to do with your students. Another mystery in mathematics is pi. And pi shows up in a lot of different areas. And because of the length of the seminar, we're just going over a few. But one place it shows up is there's been a study done by this guy named Stalham, and I got it from the Fermat's Enigma book. But he suggests that if you take all the rivers and you were to look at their length from start to finish just as the yellow, okay? And then if you were to take that number and divide it by the distance as the bird flies, right, from start to finish, that they average out, if you take a whole bunch of rivers, it averages out to pi. And it's just kind of this phenomenal, weird characteristic of rivers. And so what ends up happening, rivers when they start off are fairly straight, but then they start banking in and they start cutting away at their banks and they start getting windier. But as they reverberate, they kind of mediate. And he says, this guy argues in this study, that it mediates at pi. And like we were talking about earlier, you know, Linda says, I would have picked 3, you know, not 3.14. Well, why did God, you know, we don't know why this happens. But these are the fun things. There's all kinds of different things. And in an earlier seminar Deborah Robinson, she was talking about the Fibonacci series and the Fibonacci series and its prevalence in nature as well. The Fibonacci series is a series of numbers. When you add the previous two numbers, it gets you the third number. So 1 plus 1 is 2, 1 plus 2 is 3, 3 plus 2 is 5, 5 plus 8 is 13. Fibonacci was an Italian. He lived in Italy during medieval times, and he got a lot of his math education just by traveling, and he would travel to Arabia, and Arabia at the time was the kind of the giants in math. And so he wrote in his book, Liber Abaci, about this Fibonacci sequence, and his original example was about rabbits, okay, and the procreation of rabbits. And the way that rabbits procreate, he did it like in months, it comes out to a Fibonacci sequence. And I would show you if I had more time, but we're just going to show you one example with another place in nature where the Fibonacci series comes up, and Deborah pointed this out earlier. But if you look at the spirals one way of a pine cone, it comes out to 8 spirals. And there's a second set of spirals that you can see going the other way, and this comes out to 13 spirals, and it comes out to a consecutive pair of Fibonacci numbers. And this also happens in sunflowers. Okay, you can also find the Fibonacci series, and its Fibonacci series is closely related to the golden ratio. And a lot of stuff, if you're interested, you can find in this book called The Golden Ratio by Mario Livio. It's got some good stuff in the book and some average stuff. But some other places where you find it is in the spiral pattern of falcons when they're attacking. Who knows why, and who knows who figured this out, too. Spiral galaxies, also in the procreation of bees. So these are the mysteries of mathematics. And another one is paradoxes. Paradoxes are super fun to do with students, where you're sitting there going, you know, would you really get your kids thinking about something that they assumed made sense, and then you get them thinking contrary to this. And Zeno was famous for his paradoxes. He was a Greek as well. And one of his paradoxes, which I especially love, it still confuses me, but he argued that that the tortoise would beat Achilles in a race if he was given a 100-meter head start. Okay, if the tortoise is given a 100-meter head start, he would beat Achilles in a race. There's no way that Achilles could pass him. And his reasoning went like this. If he was 10 times as fast, if Achilles is 10 times as fast as the tortoise, in the time it takes the tortoise to go 10 meters, okay, well, Achilles would go 100 meters, right? But in the time that it takes the tortoise to go 1 meter, the Achilles would go 10 meters. Well, what about if the tortoise goes, you know, 0.1 meters? Then Achilles still wouldn't pass him. And the paradox comes into the thing. He keeps on going, but he's never going to pass him because there's an infinite amount of points that Achilles has to reach in there. Another way to look at this paradox is if I'm to start at this side of the room and go to that side of the room, Zeno says, in order to get there, I have to go halfway. And in order to go halfway, I need to get halfway there. And in order to go halfway here, I need to go halfway there. And in order to get here, I have to go halfway there. And then obviously you get the point. He just keeps on going. He goes, no, I can never get there because first I have to get that point. Well, what about, but there's a point in between that, right? And you get these paradoxes that don't make sense. And Zeno was convinced that our senses betray us, and he actually thought you couldn't get to the other side of the room, which I don't know how that makes sense with reality, but that's what he figured. So those are fun to do with your students. There's some fun exercises in probability that can be done. Probability theory started off with a guy named Girolamo Cardano. He was a crazy gambler, wild story for him. And Pierre de Fermat and Blaise Pascal continued it and really further developed it. Especially Pascal was the one that really developed what we know as probability theory. Probability is a great way to bring about critical thinking in our students and can be easily applied to a variety of different age levels. It's especially fascinating as many examples of concepts counterintuitive to our own experience. One of the most famous probability things is how many people would there have to be in a group in order for the probability to be half that at least 2 people in it have the same birthday? So, you know, we could just ask the question, what's the probability that 2 of us in this room have the same birthday? And it would be surprising to you that the probability that 2 of us in this room right now have the same birthday is very high. It is very, very high. And for the probability for 2 people to have the same birthday in any given group, it's to be 50%, you only need 23 people. If you have 23 people, you are at 51% that you have 2 people that have the same birthday. Johnny Carson heard about this and thought this doesn't make sense. So he had some mathematician or some guy on his show that said this. He goes, yeah, there's a probability. And so he goes, well, I'm going to test this. And he goes, my birthday is October 23rd. And he goes, who in this room has a birthday of October 23rd? And no one raised his hand. How? What was he messing up? How was Johnny Carson wrong in his application of this? Well, it doesn't say that it's 51% that they have his birthday. It's just, it's likely that there are two people in that room. So he needed to ask the question. It would have been a lot more work on his show. Okay, but for it to be 51%, all you have to have is 23 people. So if you're in a class, I have a class of three, so it's a little bit harder. But if you have a class of 23 or more, do it. And it's fun. You'll see that more often than not, 23 or more will have this, two people the same birthday. Has anyone heard of the Monty Hall problem? Okay, I love the Monty Hall problem. It's so much fun to do. I'm kind of running out of time, so I'll do my best to explain this. But the Monty Hall problem can be summed up. There was if you know who Marilyn Vos Savant is, she's famous for being one of the women with the highest IQ. But someone sent her a question and said this: suppose you're on a game show and you're given the choice of three doors. Behind one door is a car, behind the other is goats. You pick a door, say number one, and the host, who knows what's behind the doors, opens another door, say number three, which has a goat. He then says to you, do you want to pick door number two? Is it to your advantage to switch your choice? Let me show you what I mean. Let's say you pick door number one, and then the host says, okay, let me show you something. There's a goat behind door number two, okay? Should you switch to door number three? This was the question that was posed by this, right? And she says in her column, she goes, you should, probabilistically, this doesn't make sense. At least 90% of people get this wrong, okay? So if you're getting it wrong, don't feel bad. You should switch. It's for your benefit to switch. And she gets all these letters, and she gets letters from PhD mathematicians. They're coming. You blew it. One guy's like, you're using female logic, you know. Everyone's writing into her saying, you're wrong. I mean, these people are saying, no, it's 50-50. Your chance is 50-50. Well, let's look at it. And you definitely could do this with your students. It's fun. Even do a sample time. If you pick this, what's your probability of getting the car right now? 1 out of 3, right? What's your probability that the car is behind one of those two doors? What's your probability of this? It's 2 out of 3, right? Your probability of getting it when you pick door number is 1 is 2 out of 3. When the game show host tells you that there's a goat behind there, act like it's closed, but it's not. What's the probability that it's behind one of those two doors? It's still 2 out of 3 that it's behind one of those two doors, okay? And so you should switch, okay? And there's the car, okay? Now, everyone's going to bring an example when they didn't switch and they got the car. It's still 1/3 that you might get it if you stay. What's fun to do this with your students is say there's another good technique when looking at problems like this is to extrapolate the situation. Let's say that you were on a show where they had 1,000 doors, right? And you picked door number 76, okay? And then what happened is they showed you the contents, the game show has showed you the contents of every other door except for 624. And then you found out these are all little goats here, okay? And you find out there's a whole bunch of goats there. Would you switch then? Yeah, you would, right? You just picked this. What's your chance of 76? 1 out of 1,000. What's the chance that it's behind one of those other doors? 999 out of 1,000, right? And there's the car behind there. I love this problem because even one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century got it wrong, Paul Erdős. So whenever I get a problem wrong in class, I'm going to be like, hey, Paul Erdős missed the Monty Hall problem. Okay, and so, but again, it's fun to look at this. And you do this with your kids. You can actually set up boxes with goats and cars and do 100 tries or 50 tries or something like that where they don't switch, and you'll find out that they win the car I've done this twice now, and it worked out. And it works out about 1/3 of the time. And then you do it where they do switch every time, and you'll get 2/3. You'll win the car, okay? All right, additional ways to enhance the math curriculum. I have to go through this a little bit quickly, but we need to really strengthen our students' ability to compute mentally. We talk about it, but mental math is important, is very important. I think of a story about Carl Gauss. Carl Gauss was a very famous mathematician. One time he was in class, and the teacher just wanted to give him some busy work and said, hey, I want you guys to add up the integers 1 to 100, right? And Carl Gauss, I'm done, okay, just like 5 seconds later. And what he did was he didn't just start like all the other kids, go 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5. He goes 1 plus 1 to 100. 1 plus 100 is 101. 2 plus 99 is 101. 3 plus 98 is 101. So basically, you have 50 pairs of 101. So what's 50 times 101? 5,050. He's thinking mentally. And what I do is I can bring up that example. Don't expect your kids to do that. But you bring up that example and try to cultivate that, you know, and you try to get them to think mentally. Calculators, I think, you should use very... I don't try to use it before Algebra 2. I don't think it's not necessary before Algebra 2. The calculators have a great purpose, a great use, and when they start using them, teach them how to use it and show them all the great things about it. But be careful, because it becomes a dependent thing for them. Riddles are an excellent way to cultivate critical thinking. I use riddles very often. Here's just a basic riddle. 4 lines to connect all the dots. There's 4 lines. I have to go through this real quick. There's calculators. Children's books. There's some children's books that have good mathematical concepts. I mean, they're real basic, but you can get a lot of children's books at the grammar stage that can incorporate mathematical thinking and get them familiarized with numbers. I think it would be great if we started thinking about a math catechism. What are the important terms? And, you know, sit there and say, what is the chief end of mathematics? To discover the order and harmony of God in the natural world and enjoy Him forever. That's just kind of fun. But you know, don't depend upon your curriculum to develop what you want them to know. Okay, you need to develop the important terms, integers, natural numbers, and so on. I don't think there should be any time during class where they're just hanging out. We'd rarely play games during class, but you know, if you have that free time, there's a lot of games that can incorporate mathematical thinking. Okay, chess, obviously, and so on. Have you ever met a person that's good at chess that's not good at mathematics? I don't think so. How do we fit it all in? Real quick, we don't. I'm over my time right now, so we don't. But we do the best we can, okay? And what you guys want to do is sacrifice a lesson here. I don't think it's the most important thing to finish a textbook. Get them to think critically. We are not creating machines, but thinkers. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. All right, I don't have time for questions and answers, but if you have questions, please come up to me afterwards. I'm sorry I didn't give you time. But thanks for coming. Here's a list of some of the books that we have.